The Heal Podcast has been created to explore my favorite ingredients for a long-term, sustainable, healthy human experience. We take an informed look into topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanding consciousness. Heal stands for healthy eating and living, so why not sit back, relax, be present, and enjoy the conversations about this unique gift we were all given, called life. If you feel this podcast has resonated with you, please feel free to share it with your friends, family, and colleagues, as the gift of knowledge is something wondrous. Thank you for your open hearts and minds. Alrighty, let's get into some delicious healing.
If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows, and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com.
Professor Charlie Teo, AM, is not your typical neurosurgeon. In demand across all continents for his willingness to offer surgery to those who have been given no hope, he has appointments in Australia, USA, India, Vietnam, and Singapore. As passionate about teaching as performing surgery, Charlie has been awarded Best Teacher Awards in both the USA and Australia and devotes 3 months of his time every year instructing and doing live surgery in developing countries. He has also established a fellowship program that attracts over 600 applicants every year and has trained and mentored neurosurgeons from many of the world's leading universities, such as Johns Hopkins, Stanford, Duke, and Harvard universities. Professor Teo strongly believes that a surgeon's responsibility to his patients shouldn't end after surgery. In keeping with his desire to find cures for recurrent brain tumors, he has raised over $20 million for research. He has done this through the Cure for Life Foundation, the Cure Brain Cancer Foundation, and currently the Charlie Teo Foundation. His efforts were recognised in 2011 when he was appointed a member of the Order of Australia, in 2012 when he was invited to give the Australia Day address to the nation, and then in 2013 when he was the first non-politician Australian to address the US Congress on the need for more funding for brain cancer research. Charlie is a father to four beautiful daughters and supports the rights of girls and young women in impoverished countries such as Cambodia and India through various charities, including his own Teo Family Foundation. To find out more about Charlie Teo, visit his website charlieteo.com.au. That's charlieteo.com.au.
Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
How are you?
Oh, I'm very good, yeah.
So, Charlie, who are you and what do you do for a job?
So my name's Charlie Teo and I'm a neurosurgeon who specialises in brain tumours. And it used to be just paediatric brain tumours, but now it's both adults and kids. I'm Australian, but of Chinese heritage. I work mostly in Australia, but I also have appointments globally at Duke University in North Carolina, National University Hospital in Singapore. I operate out of India a lot, Vietnam, Germany, China. So, yeah, I guess I'm a global neurosurgeon who specialises in brain tumours.
So a neurosurgeon, explain what that is and in relation to brain tumours.
So a neurosurgeon is someone who operates on or around the brain and spinal cord. Given that the spinal cord, its structure, its degeneration creates more patients, most neurosurgeons practice consists of 70 to 80% spine work and about 10 to 20% brain work. I decided I wanted to specialise in brain work and not the spine, and then I wanted to subspecialise even further on brain tumours only. So it's a pretty unique practice. In fact, no one in Australia does purely brain surgery. All other neurosurgeons, bar none, have a spine practice as the majority of their practice. So it's a pretty unique practice.
So talk to me about the brain and how does a tumour form in a brain?
So a brain tumour just means lump. And there are benign tumours and malignant tumours. Benign tumours are almost by definition curable with surgery. Of course, because of their location, some aren't curable, but treatable. And then there are malignant tumours, which is brain cancer, which unfortunately is a terrible disease. It is the worst of all the cancers, and no one will dispute that. It carries a almost 100% mortality rate. And only 5% of patients live more than 5 years, which is terrible. And unfortunately, like I said, it's the majority of all the brain tumours that we see are these malignant tumours. They're given various names, GBM, glioblastoma multiforme, grade 4, high grade, glioma, malignant glioma. They're all the same thing. It's brain cancer.
Is it becoming more prevalent?
That's a controversial subject. There have been some recent studies that show a significant increase, almost an exponential increase in the incidence of brain cancer. Others dispute that, but there are two studies that I quote, CB Truss, which is the Central Brain Tumour Registry of the United States, which showed an almost exponential increase in brain tumours, and a UK-based study that showed the same thing, especially of a tumour called an ependymoma and a tumour called a GBM or glioma.
When you say exponential, what does that mean for somebody that's never heard of that?
It means that, so it can either be linear, in other words, just a gradual increase, which is the same virtually every year, same increase every year, or exponential means where it's going like an exponential curve, where it's actually increasing quite rapidly.
Do you have any thoughts on why that is happening?
Look, my thoughts are controversial. I will mention them, but suffice it to say that there is really no answer as to the etiology or the cause of brain cancer. There's speculation, and pretty significant speculation. So the one that I'm sure you've heard of is the exposure to electromagnetic radiation. It's very low frequency, EMR. And it all started because a study out of Chicago and the Netherlands many decades ago showed that if you lived around high-powered, high-tensile electrical wires, you had a higher incidence of cancer, brain cancer being one of them. They tried to extrapolate that information to mobile phones and the fact that mobile phones do emit EMR, not at the same frequency, and do mobile phones and all the other EMR that we expose to, do they increase your risk of getting brain tumours and especially brain cancer? And there was pretty compelling studies to show that it may. So some people came out and started warning the public. Of course, the EMR producing companies, like mobile phone companies, started disputing it, and they carried out a huge study called the Interphone study. It went for many years, very good study, robust, and it took a long time to publish, though. And so it became quite controversial. Between the collection of the data and the publication, there were several years, and people didn't like that. You know, why are you holding back the information sort of thing, especially since the study was actually funded by telcos. So, you know, everyone started thinking, you know, they're trying to hide something, and many of the countries that were involved in the Interphone study started publishing their own data from the Interphone study, and most of them showed a connection between brain cancer and mobile phone usage. Then the Interphone study came out, I think it was around 2010, and it showed that there was no link between brain cancer and mobile phone usage. But if you read the fine print, it went on to say that if you were a high usage person, and that was only half an hour a day in those days, so if you use your phone more than half an hour a day, then it increased your risk of developing a brain cancer on the side of usage by 2.5 times. So that was quite compelling, given that the null hypothesis of the paper was to actually prove that there wasn't a relationship. So it really needs quite robust statistics to actually show there is a relationship. And so people started using the Interphone study to either refute or support their argument that the two were related. And, you know, it's like all science. You can read it the way you want to read it. And for every study that shows something, there's also another study that shows exactly the opposite.
Do you put your phone near your head?
No. Well, my philosophy is, look, if the jury's out, But there's speculation. Why push it? You may as well just presume that there might be a link and try and mitigate the risk. And, you know, hold the phone away from your head. Try not to put it anywhere near your head when you're asleep at night, for example. Keep it well away from your head. And it's not going to hurt you to do that, and it could actually save your life.
Off topic, but continuing on with this topic, 5G, have you got any thoughts about that and what that the potential for that is?
Look, I'm not an expert on 5G, 4G, the physics of EMR, but I'm an expert on brain cancer, that's all. But I do know that the patterns are improving. So when we first used the bricks, those huge phones, they emitted huge amounts of energy. And we used to hold them right next to our head and stay on them for hours at a time. They're the people who got brain cancer. I can name them for you. I've seen lots of patients who were on those phones when they first came out. Their business mandated it. They were on them for up to 6 hours a day. They got brain cancer. These days, thankfully, the trend is to hold them away from your head, text message, et cetera, et cetera. Plus, of course, the energy emitted from these phones is significantly less than the old bricks. So I'm hoping that maybe there was a bit of a peak when we were using the bricks, but now that we'll see a reduction in the damaging effect of EMR.
Children with brain cancer, how, why?
That's the statistic that I hate the most, and that is that brain cancer in Australia and the United States causes more deaths in children than any other cancer, in fact, any other disease. So it's the number one killer of children. And why should kids be afflicted by this terrible cancer? No one knows. We haven't done enough work in it. It's one of those orphan cancers. It gets very little funding, considering it has a huge impact on society, not only because it kills our young, but it also has a huge socio-economic impact on society, in fact, number one. And despite those two facts, you know, the fact that it's actually hurting us as a society and the fact that it's killing our children, you would think it would get the most amount of government funding. It actually gets the least amount of government funding. And, you know, everyone asks me, oh, why is that? Why is that? Well, I think it's because most people adopt a very nihilistic approach to brain cancer. And, you know, well, they're going to die anyway. We've made no difference in the stats. It's a terrible disease. We've got nothing to offer people. So they sort of steer away from it, which, of course, then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you steer away from it and don't put funds and research into it, of course, it's going to continue killing kids. And so, no, it's a terrible disease with terrible outcomes.
So when you operate, you put on your gown.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you go into each operation.
Well, again, it's a little bit depressing. Of course, when you're operating on a benign tumour, it's great. It's high risk. It takes a lot of skill. And you can cure a patient. You can change their lives from death to life.
By removing the tumour?
Benign tumours, absolutely. Yeah. No, I did one in Singapore a few days ago, and that kid would have died in the next few days or weeks, and turned out to be a benign tumour. Very difficult, took me 11 hours, but got it all out, and he's probably going to die of old age, hopefully. But malignant tumours, it's a different kettle of fish. Malignant tumours, you buy them time. You can sometimes improve their quality of life. You certainly give them hope. But no, unfortunately, the stats are stacked against them, and you're probably only going to cure a few of them, a handful.
How do you stay grounded and centred?
I think the good comes with the bad. You know, when you get very close to your patients, which I've been criticised for, yeah, you do feel the emotional toil and the emotional price you have to pay for when patients do badly, either from surgery, my surgery, or from the disease itself. But then again, you get the reward from those patients whose lives you change. I mean, I had a letter from a young guy who thanked me for giving him another few weeks of life. That's all I gave him. Maybe 2 months, 3 months max. And he wrote me this letter on his deathbed and said, thank you very much. In the last, you know, 3 weeks, I spent some time with my girlfriend. I bought a dog. I named the dog after you. You know, I mean, life is very precious. And again, people who criticise me for giving people a few weeks or a few months or a few years of life are sitting in their sort of little protected box, and they're not facing death. You know, they're not facing it straight down the barrel. And so they become very judgmental and say, oh, you know, it's not worth it, it's futile, you're giving people false hope and all these criticisms of me and my approach to patients is all based on the fact that they have never actually faced death in the eye. And so how can they judge people for wanting to live just a few more weeks or a few more months or just to have the hope of maybe living even longer? So, you know, you should walk a mile in someone's shoes before you judge them and judge the reasons for why they, you know, are going through a very risky operation just for the hope of either living or living a little bit longer.
Where did you learn your compassion from and your understanding of humans?
I don't know. You see, you call it compassion. You know, other people call me this extraordinary doctor, but I don't think I'm that extraordinary. I mean, I don't think I do anything more than a normal doctor should do. I mean, I put my patients first. I treat them with respect and I treat them as if they were a member of my own family. That's the criteria I use. And I think all doctors should do that. Yeah, that's why you're in medicine. You're in medicine for the patient. You're not for yourself or your own empire building or your own financial gain or your own ego. You're in it for the patient. So that's all I do. I promise you, I'm not eating humble pie. I really believe I'm not extraordinary at all. All I am is doing exactly what I thought doctors should do.
Which is?
Care for your patients and treat them with respect.
So what is medicine in your definition?
I'll just tell you one little story, and I think that'll define it. And, you know, I've been widely criticised by my colleagues. I'm sure you know that bit about my background. And I was once giving a talk at the Sydney Children's Hospital, and I was showing my great results. Everyone thought that I was lying. Some people thought I was telling the truth, but they couldn't explain it. And one guy gets up and goes, "Have you ever thought, Charlie, that it's not your surgical technique as to why your patients live longer? It's the fact that you're a healer." And he said it as a criticism. You know, it's the fact that you make people feel better, you give them hope, you hold their hands, and it's not this technique that you're telling everyone is fantastic. And I initially took it as an insult, but then I thought about it later. I thought, oh my God, what a lovely thing to say. What a lovely thing to say. Because I think that's what a doctor should be, not just a scientist, not just someone who learns the information and then regurgitates it, but someone who actually immerses themselves into health and healing and wellness. And so, in other words, a very holistic approach to the patient, an open mind, a caring nature, a healer, someone who does hold someone's hand, makes them feel better, and not just the drugs you give them or the injection you give them or the operation you do, but the fact that you're actually making that patient feel better because you care for them. I think that's what a medicine person should do, not just a doctor, but, you know, these medical witch doctors and things like that, and barefoot doctors in China, you know, they're healers.
A friend of mine, Bruce Lipton, wrote a book called The Biology of Belief, and he believes that we all have the capacity to heal ourselves. What's your take on that? Can a person have the ability to heal themselves with the right intention?
Yeah. Well, you know, you don't even have to add with the right intention, because it is well known that the placebo effect or the human mind is so powerful that it can do things that are totally inexplicable. So, for example, if you have pain, then we know that if you take a placebo, thinking that it's a pain tablet, in 50% of cases, your pain will be reduced. Okay, so that's the power of the mind. The fact that you think you're taking something that's going to reduce your pain. I can understand that. Listen to this. There is a study that shows that if you think you're taking a blood thinning tablet, it'll thin your blood. Now, I can't explain that whatsoever. So clearly there's a mechanism in our brain that can modify our physiology and our pathology to alter the way it's working. And by that I mean reduce pathology or induce pathology. It can change physiology just up here somehow, whether it's neural mediated, hormonal mediated, or maybe enkephalin, endorphin mediated, no one knows. But that's how powerful this is. It's an untapped resource. Thankfully, Barack Obama identified that a few years ago when he said, listen, we've mapped the human genome. It's brought us huge amounts of information and money to America. Let's map the human brain now. Let's study this unknown entity. Let this be the next frontier rather than space travel. And I was honored to be asked to address the US Congress on the fact that we needed more funding for brain cancer research, for example, because it's this huge unknown up there. So absolutely, I believe that the human brain is so powerful that it can impact pathology, disease.
Your heritage, Chinese descendant, modern medicine, Chinese medicine. Do you play in both of those fields?
Yeah. No, I think I'm pretty, not unique, but I certainly have a unique attitude towards healing and medicine. And that is, I have a background in acupuncture. Of course, I'm Chinese, and the Chinese have mastered traditional Chinese medicine for many, many centuries, or thousands of years, actually. And then I'm a doctor as well, professor of neurosurgery, very academic, hold university titles and appointments. So I think I'm the sort of product of two different philosophies, East versus West, or East meets West.
One of the things I often say is we have modern medicine or modern wisdom and ancient wisdom.
Mm.
And when we can combine those two, when we have an open mind that we can connect and appreciate both of these wisdoms, then I think the doors are open for all possibilities.
Yeah, look, I agree 100% that, look, I do concede that it's very difficult for doctors to keep an open mind. I mean, when you think about it, we're actually chosen to do medicine, and then we excel at medicine by keeping a closed mind. So it's very difficult to ask a doctor, well, hang on, now you've got to start questioning all the dogma that you've been taught. But when I went through med school, that's exactly what I was told not to do, not question the professor, learn from the textbooks, regurgitate that information, and that way I would succeed. I'd pass my exams, I'd become a good doctor, I'd receive accolades because I was a good rote learner and a good regurgitator of information. So I understand the difficulty of doctors who are chosen for their profession based on the fact that they're not left-field thinkers. They're not encouraged to have an open mind. They're actually discouraged to have an open mind. If you question the professor, you're in trouble and you won't get that position or you won't pass that exam. So then to actually turn around and say, oh, hang on, all those things we've taught you, you should question that. You should not only question it, but I'd like you to start thinking outside the box and maybe even adapt to some of these Eastern philosophies that, you know, we have taught you is absolute rubbish. Well, it's very difficult to do that, Pete. I mean, it takes a huge leap of faith to question science, or the science that you've been taught and the dogma that you've been taught.
I love it. I watched a film on the plane yesterday and I was laughing my head off because it's called Smallfoot, a bunch of Yetis. And the whole Yeti community believes in these rules of life.
Mm.
And there's one Yeti.
It comes along and questions it.
One Yeti finds a Smallfoot, a human.
Right.
He comes back to the group and says, I found a Smallfoot, I found a Smallfoot. And the king of the area says,
no, rubbish.
Are you questioning?
Yeah.
He had this coat of stones on and they get all their beliefs, like the Ten Commandments on these stones.
And yeah.
Are you questioning that the stones might be wrong? So they banished him.
Yeah.
For asking a question.
Well, what's happened to me? Completely banished. My colleagues not only have banished me, not only have they not accepted me, they have tried to destroy and continue to try and destroy me. I am a huge threat because I think outside the box and I do things that aren't evidence-based. And I operate on tumours that my colleagues have called inoperable. And how dare I question my senior colleagues or my peers and say, you know, actually, I think you're wrong. That tumour can be taken out and should be taken out. I mean, you've got to destroy someone like that. You either destroy them or you accept them. But it's a whole lot easier to destroy someone than to accept them, because to accept them, firstly, you've got to question your own beliefs. Secondly, you've got to then say, shit, for all these years, I've let those people die and I could have done something. So that's very confronting. Thirdly, you've got to upskill. And upskill means doing a course, being separated from your family, sometimes doing a fellowship overseas. And finally, that's financially and fiscally very negative because, you know, you've got to take time off your busy schedule and you're not making money, you're spending money. And so it's very, very easy to destroy someone, just come up with a vexatious complaint, and very difficult to actually accept that they're doing something different and it's good and we should adapt.
So why do you keep doing what you're doing?
It's the patients. It's got nothing to do with me. I mean, I've received my accolades and some rewards and recognition and stuff, but no, I'm not doing it for that. If you do something for a celebrity, you'll become a gutser. But if you do something for the greater good, in other words, for someone else's betterment and for non-selfish reasons, then it's the right thing to do. And eventually, right is right and justice will prevail. So those fuckers who have tried to destroy me over all these decades since I came back from America, they must have wasted so much negative energy on me. They've certainly wasted time on me. They've gone to papers, they've put advertisements in newspapers, they've taken out lawsuits against me, and I can't imagine that that negative energy has made them better people or made them healthier. So hopefully justice will prevail.
And truth.
And truth, yeah.
How important is truth for you?
Oh, it's very important. I mean, people say that I take honesty to a different level and, you know, I'm honest to a fault. Just ask my wife when she tells me if she looks good in a dress. Or, you know, I believe it's the one thing that it's one thing that's lacking in many of our leaders today. So I often say to people, why is it that I've been voted the most trusted Australian for many, many years now? And people say to me, look, it's not because people like you. It's not because people agree with what you're saying, but at least they know you're telling the truth. So that's something that is really lacking in many of our leaders, so-called leaders in society. Unfortunately, duplicity is rampant. I mean, why did Trump win the election? Trump didn't win the election. Hillary Clinton lost it. It's very, very simple. It was a vote against politicians. It was a vote against dishonesty, duplicity. And they thought that Trump, they didn't know really what he was like, they at least thought that he was going to represent non-duplicitous leadership.
Mm.
Yeah. They were mistaken. Well, that's another subject.
So I'm interested, because we spoke with Janet the other day, Janet Schloss. You're doing and helping with this clinical trial, one of the first in the world, one of the largest in the world. Talk to me about this and how cannabis entered your medicine practice.
Yeah, look, I didn't think it was going to create as much animosity and angst and negativity that it did. Because again, if you keep an open mind and if you really care for your patients, when something like this comes along, of course you're going to go, yeah, well, let's look into it. You're not going to go, you're not going to go, no, 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 no. Of course you're going to go, yes, 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 yes. Because, well, firstly, it behooves you, and it's incumbent on you as a scientist to prove if something is worthwhile or not. That's firstly. And secondly, if patients think it works and it's going to give hope to patients, well, why not at least look into it and keep an open mind to it? So, yeah, it was no big deal to me. Janet Schloss came along, Blackmores came along, patients came along and all showed an interest in this and if I would be associated with it. And it was a no-brainer, you know. I mean, absolutely. Why not?
Well, cannabis has been used in Chinese medicine and also in the culture for, I think it's 4,000 or 5,000 years throughout history. So it's interesting. What's your thought on this plant? You're a small way through this study. You've been on the planet for quite some time.
Yeah.
Skeptical about it?
No, again, look, I preempted this interview with you, Pete, telling you that I wasn't a world expert on cannabis, and I just want to make that claim right now. So, yeah, I didn't know anything about it. I mean, I've never taken drugs myself. I've never smoked. I drank alcohol. My body's a temple and I treat it with a lot of respect. So it's not as if I had a background in cannabis. I'll tell you one funny story. I mean, I once ate a cannabis cookie. What do they call them? Hash cookie. And, you know, I went to this party in Glebe, very bohemian part of Sydney, Australia. And there was a very good looking girl there smoking dope. And I think I, you know, want to impress her. So when I sat next to her, she goes, hey, do you want a joint? And I go, oh, no, thank you. Oh, and she goes, what, you don't take drugs? And I go, oh, no, I take drugs, but, you know. And anyway, she goes, well, do you want a hash cookie? I go, yeah. Oh, yeah, hash cookies, yeah, for sure. So this is someone whose body is incredibly pure, never once taken a drug. I ate this hash cookie and I was off my face. And I had my motorbike outside, and I got back on the motorbike to ride home, and the road was all over the place, and I was disorientated, so I had to leave the bike there and walk home. And so I'll never forget that it has huge psychoactive effects, certainly on someone who's never taken it like me. And that was my only interaction with dope. And apart from watching my friends take it and go funny and glassy-eyed and things like that. So I had no preconceptions, except that I knew it was a psychoactive drug. I had no negative or positive thoughts about it. I didn't have much knowledge about it. And again, it's just purely that I wanted to keep an open mind and treat it like a scientist should, and that is accept it and then try and prove or negate its effects.
Do you believe that this plant could be a medicine?
Well, I have done some research now, and if I could just reiterate what I said before, and that is that science is so confusing for scientists, let alone for the layman, because for every study that you find that actually says something, there's another study that says it's wrong. And when you read those papers, they all sound pretty damn good to me. Their statistics are good, they spin it well, and so it's very confusing for even a scientist, academician, to read the literature and interpret it. Oh my God, it must be impossible for the poor old layman. So I'm going to say the same thing again. I'm going to stay negative. I'm going to stay neutral until I prove something. And that's why I did the study. If you look at the literature on cannabis, and I saw the update by NCI, National Cancer Institute, in January this year. Yeah, so if you look at the literature on cannabis, and I'm talking the recent update was only January 2019, there are no human studies, clinical studies, to show or negate a positive effect of cannabis. So we have clearly, as a group, kept a very closed mind to cannabis. And yes, there are animal studies. I'm sure you know them as well as I do. And they're very good animal studies, but no human clinical trials to this date to show the effects of cannabis. So we've been really, really irresponsible to the public for not doing that. There was enough pressure on us to conduct a study on the benefits or otherwise of cannabis in brain cancer patients. We therefore designed a study that allowed us to at least evaluate the effect of CBD. So as you know, there are two components. And CBD is the one that we believe is the active component, cannabinoids, acting on CB1 receptors in the brain. We believe that THC might have a potentiating effect on that, so we're conducting a study where we escalate the amount of THC versus CBD on these patients. Why do we believe we can come up with answers in such a small study in such a short period of time? It's because of the nature of brain cancer. People die quickly. And many other cancers, you won't get answers for years and years and years because it takes them years and years and years to die. But brain cancer patients mostly die within a year of diagnosis. So we have a patient population that will hopefully give us answers pretty quickly if it has any benefit at all, or in fact negative effect at all, because we'll see it pretty quickly. So when we opened the study, we didn't really even go public, and we had a huge number of people wanting to join the study. And why is that? Because again, many other cancers have many other different BSTs, best standard treatments. So breast cancer, for example, the first line treatment, if it doesn't work, there's second line. There's third line, there's fourth line, there's fifth line, there's 10th line, there's 20 line treatments for some cancers where the first line treatment fails. Brain cancer, first line treatment is BST and no other treatments thereafter. So if you take temozolomide and radiotherapy and surgery and they fail, we have nothing else to offer you. Hence, we can study a drug like cannabinoids because they're not conflicting with any other second line or third line treatment. So we're in this unique position with brain cancer to see if it actually works because we've got the patient population, we've got no other known treatments, and we've got a very, very rapid death. So therefore, a very short time to actually see if it has an effect.
How many weeks into the trial are you at the moment?
So we're about a month into the trial now, where we had patient collection all done and dusted, and they're all taking it. So it won't be long before we can get some results for you.
Will you be able to share them with us?
No. No, I can't even tell you preliminary results because it's way too early.
Yeah.
But I can certainly tell you that patients feel better. So the patients that are on it are already getting some psychological benefit from being on it.
Quite a few of the doctors and people that we've spoken to on this documentary talk about dying with dignity, and that cannabis may be a tool for that. Whether on their final days or weeks, and cannabis for quite a few of them helps to alleviate pain and bring them back into themselves so they can interact in a more meaningful way with their family and friends.
Mm.
Can you talk about that? Whether it be cannabis, but just death with dignity.
I don't think even the scientific community are disputing the fact that some drugs make people feel better, and by feeling better, you live longer. And what I mean by that is that we all know that feeling better improves your immune system. We all know the immune system plays a role in the treatment and the cause of cancer. So surely anything that improves your immune system should have a beneficial effect. That's firstly. Secondly, in terms of quality of life, of course you're going to want to live longer if you're feeling good, and you want to die earlier if you're feeling terrible. So if you can feel good, you should almost by definition live a bit longer. So those beneficial effects of taking something that you believe is helping you, hope, and that is helping you, i.e. anti-nausea or less pain, is surely going to improve survival statistics, just those two things alone. So no one's disputing that. What we want to do is try and ascertain whether there's a true direct anti-cancer effect on a cellular level from cannabinoids. That's the answer that we are looking for.
And if it does show up positive, if it shows that there's an improvement, what next?
If we do well-conducted studies like this one that we're running now, then, yeah, I think the scientific community will listen. I mean, you know, I was pretty negative on my fellow colleagues about being conservative in their thinking, not thinking outside the box. But to their credit, or to our credit, once you show a robust class one study, class two, class three study, I mean, we do listen and believe that. So a class one study is a double-blinded, placebo-controlled study. It's where everyone's blinded, the people who are giving the drug and the people who are assessing the drug. Plus, there's got to be a limb or an arm of the study that where you have placebo. That's class one evidence. So if you show a doctor class one evidence about a drug, he or she will listen to that evidence.
The breakthroughs in medicine that you've seen over the years and that you've been a part of, what does it take to change people's minds? Or maybe changing the minds isn't the right, opening people's minds or opening their perception?
Oh, well, no one's ever asked me that question, Pete. It's a good question. I've struggled with this for decades now because of the experience that I've had experiencing the wrath of my colleagues. Is there some way that you could navigate this space and not induce the wrath of your colleagues? I don't know the answer. I thought the answer might be to select your medical students better. But how do you do that? Because medical students are so smart that they study what they have to, you know, like there was a movement a few decades ago where people did identify the fact that a lot of doctors were lacking compassion. And so they said, okay, let's pick our medical students based on compassion. Well, how do you do that? So, well, you can do it through an interview. You can also do it by asking them, you know, if they've shown compassion, have they worked at nursing homes and done volunteer work and things like that. But these people are so smart that they go and do their 6 weeks at a nursing home because they know they have to. Or they read the book so they can give the right answers. Oh, of course I'm compassionate. I do this. And if I saw a dog that was sick, I would lend a hand, you know, things like that. So you can't identify compassion, open-mindedness, caring nature on an interview or through a CV. You just can't do it. And hence, we still pick our medical students based on a bloody exam and how well they can rote learn. So of course you're going to get a group of people who almost by definition aren't going to be open-minded and aren't going to be risk-taking. I mean, they've even done studies on, you know, there is a gene that codes for risk-taking. It's overexpressed in criminals and extreme sportsmen. Therefore, do we let criminals into medicine because they're risk-takers? Well, we can't do that. And do we pick doctors based on the fact that they're extreme sportsmen? Well, you can't do that because a lot of them die and don't ever make it. And a lot of them aren't, you know, so smart. So, you know, what do you do? How do you pick a group of people who you want to be open-minded, caring, thinking outside the box? How do you pick them to do medicine? It's near impossible. I tried to do it. So I came back with these great intentions of, you know, I'm going to pick a whole lot of medical students who I believe are like-minded. So I applied to the, you know, the university. Please, can I be a selector of medical students? Yeah, absolutely. You've got, you know, a professor of neurosurgery, this and that. So I got on the selection committee. I'm telling you, you sit at that table and they give you 4 pages of questions you're not allowed to ask because they're not politically correct. So you look through this sheet of paper and you think, that's exactly the question I'd like to ask someone. That's exactly the information I'd like to know about that person. But no, I'm not allowed to ask it because it's politically incorrect. So I thought, oh, bugger it. So I got off the selection committee. I don't choose medical students now. I try and modify their behaviour. I try and sort of teach them caring and treating their patients correctly and with respect. But I'm not picking them anymore. And I don't think it's just too hard. It's a great question, Pete, because I can't answer it. I can't answer how you can create a doctor who is not only intellectually good, academically good, risk-taking, good at rote learning, has a caring nature, selfless. I mean, how do you create that person? It's very, very difficult. Or how do you pick that person? It's very difficult.
Can you see why you are the person that's actually right here, right now, doing this trial?
I can see why, but it baffles me as to why more people don't keep an open mind. It's incumbent on a carer, on a healer, to keep an open mind to all things that potentially could help their patients. So, you know, Reiki, for example. I mean, God, if you saw a Reiki person giving Reiki to someone, you'd think, oh, well, that's a bit weird. Or tapping. But if you actually do your research into it and look at metaphysics and quantum physics, there may be some science behind Reiki because, you know, the changing of molecules, even without laying on hands or even without touching someone, can actually have a knock-on effect. And again, I don't blame scientists for looking at a Reiki master and going, holy shit, you know, that person's crazy. But then look into the information, read up on it, you know, learn a little bit about quantum physics, and actually it may have... There could be a scientific basis to it.
I studied Reiki 25 years ago.
Did you?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, when I first saw Reiki people, I thought they were fucking crazy. But then I read a little book, you know, Quantum Physics for Beginners, and it made me realise that for every molecule that's moved here, there's a molecule moved somewhere else in the world. So there may be some actual scientific merit behind the laying on of hands or the non-laying on of hands.
One of the interesting things that I've learnt from this plant on this journey is that it can open people's hearts and it can open people's minds.
Well, that's not what I've experienced. Oh my God, I've had phone calls. As soon as people heard that I was running a cannabis trial, my fellow doctors, oncologists, radiation therapists, neurosurgeons, neurologists ran me up and just berated me. I go, holy shit, I had no idea it was that controversial. To be fair to them, there are some side effects of cannabis. There are some studies to show that it may interact with chemotherapeutic agents. It induces the P450 system, the enzyme system in the liver. That's the very same system that actually can metabolize or break down chemotherapeutic agents. So there is this sphere, which is actually quite founded, that there may be a negative, some people say a positive, interaction between cannabis and chemotherapy. So I do understand that they have their concerns, but that's why we're doing the study. We're trying to address those concerns.
But I guess where I was going was maybe a couple of drops of CBD oil for the people that are closed-minded or
and stitched up
harder. Maybe able to, you know, maybe cannabis might be their gateway to looking at life differently. And I'm not talking about smoking. I'm talking about maybe just a few little drops. A few little drops.
In their breakfast.
So it could be a magic plant after all.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, it could be. I like that. It might make some of my colleagues more chilled and more open-minded.
I get this picture of Parliament sitting around and for them all to have a smoke before they go in there.
Oh, my God.
Could you imagine?
Oh, my God. Can you imagine that? It's like when people conduct meetings and you're not allowed to sit down, you have to stand up. It changes the whole climate of that meeting. it makes people, you know, more focused, and we've got to get out of here, we can't sit down and relax. Well, imagine if they went into that meeting on cannabis, on either smoking it or taking the oil. It could really change the whole face of the planet. I like it.
Thank you, brother.
Pleasure.
The information, views and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.